Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Anyone with a smartphone is familiar with its location services and apps. They track workouts and map travel. A recent New York Times investigation found that they can get a lot more personal, too. And that matters when more than 1,000 popular apps use tracking technology and also sell the data to advertisers. New York Times technology reporter Natasha Singer worked on the story. She joins us by phone. Welcome back, Natasha.
Thanks for having me.
How do you describe how pervasive the tracking is?
We got a hold of a data set of locations attached to cell phone IDs that are typical of these companies in the business that are trading on consumers' location data. And over a three-day period, it tracked 235 million locations on more than a million devices. And we found that, like, one person's cell phone was tracked more than 14,000 times in a day. And so what I think is that consumers, you know, when we enable location services, we want to get local weather. We want to get local sports. We want, if we're going running, to log our miles. But we found that most consumers do not understand that once they enable location services, they can be tracked very specifically, very exactly, at an incredible magnitude, like the frequency of the collection, and then it can spread to dozens of companies.
The data is anonymized, though, meaning that it doesn't identify who is being tracked. What's the leap there? What difference does it make if it's anonymized?
So the industry says it's anonymous, and what they mean by that is it doesn't have your name attached to it, and it doesn't have your phone number. But it does have a unique ID that they collect all your information under and trade your information under. So they're going to know where you live, where you work, if you go to a church, a synagogue, or a mosque, that you went to the doctor, that you went to Alcoholics Anonymous, that you went to Planned Parenthood, that you went to the liquor store. So it's not actually anonymous, it's pseudonymous. And then what we did in our investigation was we got hold of this industry data set, and we asked for volunteers, and we found people who were willing to let us look them up, and they gave us their home addresses and where they worked. And based on that, we could find them in the data set. So it would be easy for anybody who worked at one of these companies or somebody who bought the data, if you knew where somebody lived, to identify them, or if you saw a house where somebody lived, you could look up in real estate records who lived there. So it is de-anonymizable.
We're talking about a recent report from the New York Times regarding the tracking apps on our phones. They track our workouts, they map our travel, but they do so, for a price. And the price is we give the app companies the right to sell that data to other companies, mostly advertisers. My guest is Natasha Singer. She's a New York Times technology reporter who worked on this project. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Natasha, are the companies responding with basically a trust us, we won't abuse this kind of a thing?
Well, when we went, you know, we contacted more than 75 companies and we interviewed executives at dozens of them. And they all said two things. One, don't worry about it, it's anonymous. And we proved it can be, you can be re-identified. So we kind of dismantled that argument. And the other one is consumers are getting free services. So this is the price they're paying. And I think that that's fair when consumers know what they're trading. But when you download an app, it often says, enable location services to get local X or Y weather, news, whatever. And it doesn't say as you're downloading it, and plus, we're going to track your location every 2 seconds and share it with 24 companies, and then they're going to sell it to hedge funds who are going to use it to try to predict foot traffic at stores and factories and, you know, see if they are going to short a stock or invest in a stock, right? Mm. So it's only a fair trade if you are fairly advised about the magnitude of the data collection, the spread, and the uses it's going to go to. So I think the argument that you're getting free services and you're knowingly trading your data is fallacious. We found a lot of deception.
And you gave a little bit of a sampling of what kind of advertisers are buying the data. Can you tell us more about the variety? I think that's what's surprising.
So basically, your data is collected by software on the app, and it's shared with different companies that use it for different purposes. One thing they can do is look at the places you have been. So let's say you're looking for a car. They will know that your phone went to a Ford dealership or a Mazda dealership or a Cadillac dealership. And so you'll be categorized as a, you know, Cadillac shopper, and then you're going to be marketed to like that. Mm. But you can also be marketed to as somebody in a low-income neighborhood or somebody who has been on a cruise. And so sometimes it will be to your advantage, and sometimes it may be to your disadvantage.
I'm going to give you I'm kind of trying, you know, I think everybody's out there sort of listening and they're trying to figure out what does this mean in the real world. So let's just say hypothetically, I go to mosque and it's tracking me there, and then I go shopping. I mean, so it's putting those two data sets together that I just visited my mosque and now I'm at the mall shopping and it's drawing conclusions or following me in that way.
Yes. So, for example, we found a teacher in upstate New York who allowed us to find her in our data set.
Okay.
And she was tracked over 800 times to her school. Sometimes even, like, her building was kind of round-shaped, and it tracked her to the side of the classroom she was on. It tracked her from school. She went to a dermatologist's office. We could tell from the data set how much time she spent in the dermatologist's office. It tracked her to Weight Watchers. It tracked her to the Marshalls next to the Weight Watchers. And then she went hiking in the hills, and it tracked her even in remote areas with her dog. And we also saw in the data set that she spent the night at somewhere that wasn't her house. And we showed her this data, and we said, you know, what's up with that? And she said, oh, that was my ex-boyfriend. Those little dots tracking my phone are, like, at my ex-boyfriend's house. And so this data set is really revealing, and it's also a national security issue. Because we saw that phones were tracked to a nuclear power plant, to the Rikers Island prison, to government installations, to military academies. And we were able to track the mayor's entourage in New York City because, you know, the mayor's based at Gracie Mansion. It's sort of in the north of New York City. Mm-hmm. And we could see him moving because he goes to a certain YMCA. And we could see the phones that moved with him and then where they went home at night. And so it's not just like a personal consumer issue that your privacy is being invaded. You know, it's a, you know, if you're a foreign government or a terrorist or you just want to, you know, bribe somebody or manipulate somebody, you can see everything about where they are in this data. And so the question is, A, do we need more transparency so people who opt into location services actually are aware of what's happening to their data? The second thing is, do we need federal privacy regulation to give consumers more choice and control over the spread of their data?
And the federal privacy stuff we've talked about before, that's something that they have in Europe, right?
Europe just enacted a law this year called the General Data Protection Regulation. And basically, the European Union decided that data privacy and data protection and security is a fundamental human right. And we don't have that in the United States. And so the law gives consumers the right to know what's happening to their data. Companies have to tell consumers the specific uses they're going to put their data to, and consumers have to consent to each different use. Consumers also have the right to see the data companies collect about them. So, like, if that's Facebook, it doesn't just mean what you posted on Facebook. It means what analysis Facebook has made about you, or if Facebook has tracked you on 20,000 other sites. Under this law, if you want to see your information, you should be shown that. And European consumers have the right to ask that their data be deleted. And so in the U.S., we do not have a federal consumer privacy law or a data protection law. We have kind of narrow laws, like we have HIPAA, which is the Patient Privacy Protection Act, where you can ask for your medical data and it can't be shared or sold willy-nilly. We have a Children's Online Privacy Protection Act that protects kids under 13, but we don't have anything that regulates the collection, use, sale, and analysis of your location data.
Have you received any feedback? Has New York Times received any feedback from policymakers about, you know, what they think about that?
Well, there were senators who are going to be involved in January in trying to draft privacy bills who went on Twitter and said, you know, it's all the more reason that we now need a privacy law.
Mm-hmm. But what is the FCC is not inclined to do this?
I think we're going to see a real fight in Congress between the folks who've been shocked at the way we've learned about big tech practices this year, starting with Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, that voter profiling company, getting its hands on the data of tens of millions of Facebook users, to the fact that like there was voter manipulation online based on targeting ads to them about their own personal habits. We've seen a lot of problems with the way big tech handles our data and targets us based on the data. And so there will be a movement among some people in Congress to try to give consumers tough privacy rights. And then there'll be other parts of Congress that feel this is a huge multi-billion-dollar industry that the United States is leading on in innovation, and any kind of regulation, in their view, is going to cramp that innovation, and maybe China will get ahead of us. And so you're going to see these two factions butting heads this year about, can we give consumers more rights and still free up businesses enough to produce new innovative products?
Meanwhile, back at the ranch, I do have the right to turn off these tracking apps, right?
So if folks want to do something, you cannot turn off all tracking. But if you have an Android phone or an iPhone, you can go into settings and you can go into privacy and you can look with each app what permissions are enabled, like have you enabled them to see your camera, your contacts, their location, and you can turn those off. And you can turn them on and off if you want from time to time, right? If you're like not going to be in London using the metro, the London Metro app doesn't need to know where you are. Mm-hmm. And if you're never going to London again, you can delete that app. So if there's apps you're not using, I suggest you delete them from your phone.
Are there some apps that are more egregious than others in terms of the detail, the number of times they check on you, and who they're selling it to?
It's really hard to tell because we used software to track the data leaving the phone from apps, and we could see a certain portion of it. But apps can also just collect the data and sell or share it with companies behind the scenes. So it's really hard to tell, you know, even if an app looks like it's not leaking data, they might be doing it by just giving it to other companies directly. But we did see some apps that were sharing users' data much more than others. So one was a weather app called WeatherBug, and we found that it was sharing users' precise location. And that means like the latitude and longitude within like a 10-foot square box with 40 companies. And we called some of those companies and said, you're getting this precise location data. What are you doing with it? Mm-hmm. And some of them said, we don't want that data. We didn't know we were getting that data. We don't store that data. You know, it's improper for them to be giving us this data. And we went back to the company and they were like, oh, well, you know, we tend to share it with our advertising partners. And if they don't want it, you know, they can turn it off. And so I think that the companies didn't have the sense that you actually have to be really careful with people's location data. It is super revealing. And like giving it to people who don't want it is not really a good kind of data security practice.
What about the national security piece of this? What kind of feedback have you gotten over that? I mean, regardless of what, you know, the current administration may feel about, you know, supporting high-tech industries, there is the responsibility to protect our national security.
And I think that we're going to see some reaction because there was a concrete example earlier this year. There was this fitness app called Strava that many people use to track their runs and share their runs. And Strava collected all that data and then put out a worldwide map showing where people were running, like in cities.
Oh, that's right,
paths.
Yeah.
And that map, you know, also lit up secret military bases around the world in the desert. And like inadvertently, just by showing where people were running, exposed potentially military personnel to risk. And so then the Defense Department came in and said, you know, folks in the military, you can't use these apps that are sharing your location. And so they're not allowed to use a number of apps in sensitive locations. And I think that in our story, where we saw phones being tracked at nuclear power plants and prisons and police stations and the mayor, I think that we're going to see that when Congress comes back into session, that there need to be some kind of special protections for those places, because otherwise they're just vulnerable.
Natasha Singer, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me again.
Natasha Singer, New York Times technology reporter. She was part of the team that wrote about how more than a thousand popular apps are using tracking technology, selling the data to advertisers, and learning a lot about how we live moment to moment and where we're at. We'll be right back with more Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Columbus residents have access to an autonomous bus. The smart circuit goes along the 1.4-mile Scioto River circuit, stopping at the Smart Columbus Experience Center, Bicentennial Park, COSI, and the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. We're going to talk about what that means to the city and what they're looking for in terms of results. Joining us is Smart Columbus Director Jordan Davis. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So the shuttle launched last week. Yep. How's its first week been on the road?
It's been great. So it launched on Monday. It runs 7 days a week, 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. We've had on average about 130 riders a day, which we're very excited about. It's a new route. So this isn't replacing an existing route or...
It's kind of a... charmed route.
Yes.
It's not really for work commuters.
Well, we didn't think so.
Okay.
And now we're already hearing feedback from people in the vehicles that they've moved their parking location over to the other side of the river and are using it for a first mile, last mile solution to get
cheaper,
into downtown.
They can park cheaper and then just take the bus. The shuttle's free?
Yeah, it's free.
That's because you want people to try it. And some people, if they eliminate the price, that encourages some people.
Exactly right. I mean, this really is a teaching and learning demonstration more than anything. There's a lot of people that have opinions about autonomous vehicles, and fairly they should. It's a part of the discourse when we think about where technology in the future is going. But not a lot of people have firsthand experiences with the technology.
There is an operator on it. They're
that
just not
correct.
Operating it. Unless they have to.
So the concept of driving is a little yeah. bit shifted in yeah. this scenario. So there is a person there that looks like they're the driver, but they are kind of attending to the vehicle's needs. The vehicle, which has a name, so Marla or Maverick is one of the vehicle's names, they're actually driving themselves through this route that we've selected. Now, the operator will have their hands on the T-bar and their foot kind of near the brake if for any reason they should need to intervene. But they also help the vehicle navigate unexpected circumstances. So if there's a delivery truck in the stop that they're supposed to stop at, the operator can take over and help that vehicle correct course.
Automatically they can?
Mm-hmm.
Have there been any mishaps?
Not yet. No, I mean, it really is safe. It's interesting that the technology's behaviors actually follows the law. So one of the interesting things is on Civic Center, one of the routes it traverses uh-huh. on Civic Center, the speed limit is 25. But what we're finding is most people are going 35. Well, the vehicle's running at speed. So any of the... instances of quick passing or anything is usually because people are breaking the law, which is an interesting thing we didn't really realize was the
how
normal
fast
behavior.
People drive.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What does it look like?
So it's really a shuttle. Like it's if you come down to the river, you can't miss it because it's there all the time. But it's a white vehicle. There's glass on the roof and which adds for a lot. So a lot of families have been coming down to see all the holiday lights uh-huh. and use it as a warm way to see a lot around the river. It seats 5 passengers, and then a 6th passenger would be the operator.
Okay.
It has 2 wide doors for people to get in and out of.
Are there lines?
It depends what time of day. Friday night there were, because it was beautiful outside and people were coming to see the
right.
lights. But they've they're frequent. They pick up, you know, every 5 to 10 minutes at each of the four stops. So it keeps people being available to jump in whenever they want.
How many are there?
There are a total of 6 okay. vehicles that we have in Columbus. 3 of them operate on the route at any given time. And that's because the vehicles are all electric. And so we need to take them off the route to charge so that they're back up to full battery.
What is this? Even I know it's just been a week, but what have you learned about what this means going forward in other parts of the city where there's just a really high demand for better transportation, that first and last mile kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, we really do believe that this is proving out that where the technology is today can serve true transportation services that we need. The vehicle itself and the service itself really is a first mile, last mile, or only mile type solution. Mm-hmm. It's not equipped to run a 20 mile route, you know, mm-hmm. across the city. It's an extender of transit or an extender of a parking experience, right?
Yeah, so. And you said it only seats, what, 4 or 5?
Yeah.
So that's not a lot.
No, there are other models that can seat 10 to 12. And we will be doing a second deployment in 2019, likely announcing that around February of next year. But that will be looking at a more neighborhood-dependent on use case. So, you know, if you think about, we didn't really know all of the nuance of how to prepare for this technology. And so a lot of what this pilot's done is helped us build the standard operating procedures that we need to have in place. We trained our fire departments, our police departments. We met with the snow warriors, so our snowplow teams, and prioritized the streets of when they're going to need to be plowed so the technology can still run. So we got all those kinks out with this one so that we can bring the technology to a first mile, last mile solution that people depend on, that if it didn't come that day, right, there would be real consequence in someone's life. In this route, we think we're okay as we learn. But the next route we do, we want it to be highly dependent on and something that we know will operate as we need it to all the time.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Columbus's first autonomous shuttle. It seats about 4 or 5 people. So far, 130-some people have used it since it started operations last week.
Per day.
Along the Smart Circuit. It's a 1.4-mile circuit along the Scioto River downtown. It stops at the Smart Columbus Experience Center, the Bicentennial Park, COSI, and the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. If you have any questions, the Smart Columbus Director, Jordan Davis, is with us today. So give us a call. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Columbus is kind of a testing ground. Who tested them before Columbus tested them?
Good question. So several communities are actually deploying or demonstrating this technology. We are not alone in this. Detroit actually is so May Mobility is our technology provider and the shuttle operator. And they are a startup out of Ann Arbor. Their first pilot or demonstration was done in the downtown Detroit, taking Quicken Loans employees from their parking to the front of the office location. That was not a public route, though. So you could only get on it if you had a Quicken Loans ID card. The other community that we look at a lot is Las Vegas. So Las Vegas has a shuttle that runs in old Vegas, downtown Vegas. And it's doing a loop there for visitors and residents as well. And
another tourist type of thing.
Yeah. And that's for residents. And they're doing surveying and all that, just like we are, to understand perception and trust and, you know, what people want of it.
How are you measuring those things?
So we have worked with, we got insight from Vegas and what their research questions have been. We also worked with Ohio State and the National Renewable Energy Lab as well to develop a questionnaire that people take essentially once they get on and off the vehicle. And we'll be looking at that and evaluating that. And that feeds up into our USDOT grant outcomes and KPIs as well.
How much does this cost, this shuttle?
Sure. So it's $600,000 for the year. So we're making it free to the public until the end of September. And there are other financing models, we think, for this technology, whether it's putting advertising on the vehicles or asking for fares as we get into more first mile, last mile type solutions. Mm-hmm. But we really wanted this one to be something free and accessible to everyone so that people can have that experience firsthand.
You think you're going to keep this route for the long term?
You know, we don't know. Okay. It is only contracted through the end of September. It will really depend on participation by the community. Do people like it? Do we use it? Do people enjoy bringing visitors to Veterans Memorial and using it to connect to COSAI? I mean, that'll truly be the metric of success, as if it's in demand or not.
How much does Smart Columbus work on any of this stuff with COTA, which, you know, that's kind of its, you know, wheelhouse?
Yeah. I mean, COTA is a tremendous partner to us throughout the Smart Columbus initiative, whether we're working on right now what's called the multimodal trip planning application, which is essentially a vision for how all of your different mobility modes could be journey planned and paid for in a single application. And they're going to be the long-term business owner of that application. We're building it, but they're intimately involved. And this project, they've been involved too from a more of a thought leadership perspective in terms of advising us on what types of operational things we need to ensure the vendor has taken in consideration and things like that.
And is there a sense about, well, let me ask you this. Are you measuring, or how do you measure the economic growth associated with something like this?
Sure. Well, I think it first starts with R&D and research and development. So how can Ohio State and our research partners benefit from this? And what type of creation activity can we generate from this? I think there is a brand reputation value from an economic development perspective as well. We are an open and smart community. These are tangible demonstrations of how we're open to innovation and we're embracing smart technologies. And so that's another big indicator that we're here for business to pilot new technologies. And the third is, you know, we want a company like May Mobility to start here in Columbus. May Mobility is from Ann Arbor. And we have the skill sets, we have the expertise, we have the research institutions. You know, Michigan has M-City, which is a private proving ground for autonomous vehicles. We have the Transportation Research Center. Theirs is about 54 acres for a smart autonomous vehicle testing. Ours is going to be 545 acres. I mean, we have a lot of incredible assets. How do we commercialize those assets into real businesses that create jobs and create the economy of the future? And so that's what we think by taking these tangible steps, by being a customer, by also being a city that's willing to try and to iterate, we can invite that type of activity here.
Shimon in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Shimon. Hello, Shimon. Okay, we don't have a Shimon on the air, I guess. I wanted to talk about what you call it, the practice, the 500 plus acres.
Mm-hmm.
What's that going to look like?
Transportation Research Center.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really incredible facility. I think it's kind of a hidden gem for the region. The Transportation Research Center has a great history. Is truly here because of leadership from the state level in Ohio State and Honda. What they are doing is building out a world-class facility for autonomous vehicles to test. And when you're testing autonomous vehicles, there's a few things that really matter. One is the randomized effects that, like, you want this vehicle to be as smart and as nimble as you are as a driver, if you're fully alert, right? Which isn't very, very common in most drivers. This city scene that they will create will allow you to do simulations of randomized events, will allow you to practice different types of signals with other vehicles, so connected vehicle technology. It will truly be a venue in which engineers and the brightest thinkers in automotive can create these different scenes so that the vehicles can practice traversing on them, get what, you know, our state calls the driver's license to come out onto real roads. We're very excited about it.
And along the Scioto Mile, is there technology that's been installed along there to react or to communicate with the autonomous shuttles?
Yes. So May Mobility has roadside units that they install on nearby street poles that look at the lights, and they provide another degree of confidence that the vehicle is seeing what it needs to see to be confident to move forward through the intersection appropriately. So if it sees the green arrow or the green light, it might have different degrees of hesitancy, right? So the green arrow, you're going to go confidently into that left turn. If it's just a green light, you might want to double check for incoming traffic.
Just like the rest of us.
So.
Describe again where people can pick this up and what the process is for using it.
Sure thing. So there's four stops on the route: the front of National Veterans Memorial Museum, in front of COSAI, at Bicentennial Park, so where the fountains are, if you're familiar with the riverfront, and then the new Smart Columbus Experience Center. So we opened our Experience Center in July of this year. That center is designed, it's, you know, our working location, but it also has a public experience center where people can come 7 days a week to test drive electric vehicles, to learn about the different projects we're working on. I talked about the multimodal trip planning. You can learn all about that. And a lot of different technologies you can see firsthand within that building that you may see one day on our streets.
If there ever is an accident, what's the protocol?
So we have a lot of different protocols in place. We've worked with the police and fire to understand response times and ensure that it can be quickly responded to. We understand the technology in the vehicle for how responders can access it and what the technology does to disable itself. There are operators. There's a command center for the vehicles as well. So the operators are in communication with the command center 24/7. By state policy and law, there has to be someone that can intervene and take over on demand inside the vehicle. And that's really the operator's role is there to do it. I would say, you know, from everything I've experienced with May Mobility, I feel really confident. Their team has extensive experience. They've been developing this technology since the beginning. And we think we chose a very equipped provider.
And the emergency operators, or whatever you call them, that go with the shuttles, are they from Michigan? Did they move them in from Michigan?
We
actually hired
22 local folks. May hired 22 local, their fleet operators, technicians, people that are doing everything from the management of the vehicles to operating them on a day-to-day basis.
Okay. Well, Jordan Davis, thanks so much for joining us
today.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Jordan Davis, director of Smart Columbus. We've been talking about that first shuttle, which launched, it's a bunch of vehicles that launched last week down on the Scioto Mile. I'm sure you can just look up Smart Columbus and find them on the internet, and they'll tell you where to go to enjoy it yourself. Check it out. More Tech Tuesdays coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. If you're still wondering what to get somebody, that little last-minute gift idea, Android Central contributing editor Russell Holly is here with more suggestions. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
Fire Stick, Fire TV, it's an Amazon Fire Stick 4K. What's different about it?
Yeah, so the Amazon Fire TV Stick has been around for a while. This is, similar to Google's Chromecast, but this one has a remote control, so kind of anyone can use it without having to use their phone. You stick this stick into the back of the television. It gives you access to Amazon and Netflix and Hulu and a bunch of other streaming services. And the big thing here is that it supports up to 4K televisions with this new model. So you can really plug this into any television and get a pretty decent streaming experience. But if you have a 4K television, then a lot of the apps that are already available on this thing will get you a better picture than the one that was available last year.
What makes it better? What changed?
It's really just, it's a more capable processor inside, so it can handle higher quality streams. So if you're watching something on YouTube or on Netflix or something like that, you can get 4K video, whereas previously that wasn't available.
In other words, it's just better, and take my word for it, you wouldn't understand.
Well, it's just visually better. Yeah, really just, it all comes down to whether you have a 4K television or not, which is still not something that even most people who stream have. 4K televisions are still not, you know, kind of the dominant form of streaming television. So it's not something that everyone needs, but it's the kind of thing that if you give and then someone upgrades to a 4K television later, they would be able to continue to use it. And the big thing here with this particular streaming stick is that they're only $35. So getting them and giving them is pretty solid for just about anybody.
It's linked to Alexa. So how does that work?
Well, so the remote control has what's called the Alexa voice remote, which means you can use the remote control to just kind of press up, down, left, right to search for things, or you can hold down the microphone button and say, you know, search for, you know, horror movies or search for Chilling Adventures of Sabrina or something like that. And if it's connected to the Amazon Prime Video service or the Netflix service, it will go and find those things and just make it easier for you to play.
That would be nice. And it sounds like for people who maybe have some disability issues, mobility, that kind of a thing, it would be helpful.
This is definitely a lot easier to use than my normal recommendation, which is Google's Chromecast, which is great for someone like me who doesn't know how to put their phone down. but if you are kind of the traditional sit down and grab a remote control when you need something TV watcher, then this is just a much more convenient and, like you said, accessible option.
Any downsides?
The biggest downside here is that it doesn't have the kind of Android and iOS friendly casting function to it. So if you are someone who uses their phone and you're used to being able to push that button and just kind of fling something that you have on your phone onto the television, that doesn't work very well. Mm-hmm. And the YouTube service on the Amazon Fire TV Stick is really limited, so it's not it's kind of difficult to mm-hmm. use compared to, let's say, the YouTube app on your phone. Because you're just using the website instead of kind of like a custom-built YouTube app. But otherwise, the experience is really good.
And at $35, it's an easy gift.
Right. It's an easy gift. And if you are in an area where Amazon's Prime delivery service is available, then you can almost assuredly get one of these either next day or same day. Mm-hmm. So they're very easy to get a hold of in most places.
All right. For those late, running late Christmas shoppers. All right. So there are a lot of external batteries on the market. You wanted to talk about the Ankler external battery. Does it actually have anything to do with the ankle?
No, this is Ankler, actually. A-N-K-E-R.
Oh. Okay. Ankler. Okay.
Ankler is a company that has been making battery backups for phones for quite a long time now, and their PowerCore 10,000, which is a very silly name, for a battery that is really just kind of an all-around good battery backup for anyone. If you have a battery that you want to stash in a purse or slide into a back pocket or just keep in a car for in the event that you know, something goes wrong and your phone is only got 10% battery left and you're waiting for something, this is a really great battery to keep around because it is small, it is lightweight, and it has just enough battery to charge any phone at least once. In most cases, it will charge the phone more than once on a single charge. And they're $32 in most cases. Mm. And they come in a bunch of different colors. You can get them in black and white and red and blue. Because if you're going to have a battery backup, it might as well be pretty.
It might as well be pretty. It has 10,000 mAh. What does that mean?
It stands for milliamp hours, which is the battery, the measurement for battery capacity. So most phones will have between 4,000 and 5,000 milliamp hours, depending on the manufacturer. And that means that this will charge most phones at least two times as long as you're not using it for anything else. But you can use this for anything. You can use it to charge your Bluetooth headset. You can use it to charge a game console if someone has a Nintendo Switch or anything like that. It has a regular USB port coming out of the side. You can use it to charge just about anything.
But it only has one USB port. So that the idea being it only wants you charging one thing at a time.
Right. It only charges one thing at a time, and it uses a full-size USB port, not a USB Type-C port, which means that it doesn't charge as fast as some of the more expensive batteries. You know, there are some batteries that you can get from Anker, in fact, that have this USB Type-C port, and that means that it will charge your phone from, let's say, 20% to 80% in a matter of minutes, whereas this will take the same rate that you would see if you, plugged into, like, your car. Or something like that, where it charges a little slower.
Well, so
but it will still.
But it claims to charge devices faster, doesn't it?
It has a what's called a quick charge function, which works with some phones, but not most.
Okay.
The high speed charging technology that it references on the retail page is great for Samsung and Motorola phones, but not great for Google or Apple or other manufacturers.
Okay. So those are two really reasonably priced, great, even stocking stuffers, depending
they
on...
They can be, yeah.
Yeah. Arcade 1-Up, your next idea, is not a stocking stuffer.
It is not.
You can neither fit it in a stocking, nor is it an appropriate price for a stocking. Tell us what it is.
Okay, so this company called Arcade 1-Up started making what are called three-quarter size arcade cabinets earlier this year. And what that means is that it is three-quarter the size of a normal arcade cabinet. So if you walk into, I know that this is not a thing that exists in many places anymore, but if you walk into an arcade gallery and you see kind of the arcade cabinets for Centipede or Asteroids or any of those games, that there's a certain size that all of them fit. They're kind of like the standard size. This is three quarters of that size, but incredibly less expensive. You look if you look on Amazon or some of the more common kind of arcade retail prices for let's say a Pac-Man arcade cabinet, they can be almost $9,000 in some cases for some of these cabinets. The ones that are made by Arcade 1-Up are a little smaller than a normal arcade cabinet, but they're $350 for what you get in one of the cases. The one that I recommend in most cases is this 12-in-1 system. So it has Centipede and Asteroids and Moonlander or Lunarlander and just a ton of other games that are kind of right from that age.
Mm-hmm.
And the cool thing about this cabinet is that all of the buttons on the top and all of the artwork on the side are all designed after the original arcade system. So it really feels like you're using kind of that normal arcade system.
I'm trying to visualize it. So it's a stand-up model?
It's a stand-up model, but it's smaller than a lot of the other ones, but not smaller. There are kind of a bunch of different sizes for these. It is not the size that you would normally put, that you would see like sitting on a bar.
Mm-hmm.
So not like the half size that you would sit on a bar. It's kind of in between those sizes.
Okay.
It comes up to my shoulders. I am not quite 6 feet tall, but it comes up to my shoulders without a riser. And they actually sell a riser separately if you want it to be the same height as a normal console.
And is this built well built? Can it take some wear and tear?
These are well built. It's almost like IKEA furniture, but for arcade cabinets. Like the
okay.
system that it shows up in is surprisingly easy to set up and install. There's very little work that goes into it once you've kind of screwed the box together. It doesn't light up like some of the older consoles where there's kind of lighting in places that'll glow.
Yeah.
But it does have variable volume control. So if you want kind of that authentic arcade volume experience, you can turn it up and it really sounds like that. But leaving that on all day will probably get you kicked out of your house.
Right, right. Well, could you put headphones on?
You cannot put headphones on, but you can turn the volume pretty far down.
Okay. For some of us, the volume is what motivates us. But how are the graphics?
This is exactly like you would normally get from an arcade machine. These are the games from the arcade. Arcade 1-Up, the name of the company, licensed these games directly from the original creators. So when you go to sit down and play these games, it is the exact same game that you would get the original Centipede, the original Asteroids. It is those games, even down to some of the bugs that are available in, let's say, Missile Command. for those games, you can still take advantage of those places. The version does not, but the version that has Pac-Man, you can actually hide in the same corner that you were allowed to hide in the original Pac-Man.
Uh-huh.
It's got a lot of the same experiences to it, and that kind of helps with that nostalgia play. But it's also just a really nice looking arcade cabinet.
Space Invaders and Asteroids were my games.
Yeah, those are great.
Are they there? I mean, I know Asteroids. You've mentioned Space Invaders.
Asteroids is on here. Space Invaders is on a different arcade cabinet. They do make one with Space Invaders, but it is not on this one in particular.
And I take it you've played it.
I have actually been fortunate enough to stand in a room where all 9 of the consoles that this company makes were there, including the one that has Galaga and Galaga 2 and one that has the Street Fighter Championship Editions and several of the other ones. They are very cool little cabinets that have been assembled. And the thing that really gets me here is the price and its availability. These are shockingly available at Walmart. For some of them are $300, some of them are $350. But they're available in most of the Walmart stores, and they're really nice.
I'm going to check them out. The headphones you wanted to talk about, bone conducting headphones. They're different than most. What's different about them?
These are super weird. I have spent all year long telling my closest friends that I love these headphones so much because they see them on my head and they look very strange. And then I put them on their head, and within a week or two, they have bought them themselves. Mm. These are made by a company called Aftershocks, which is a name that I don't like because they spell the end of the word with a Z. And that is not how you spell that word. The headphones they're called the Trex Titanium headphones, and these are bone conduction headphones, which means instead of laying over your ears or going inside of your ears, they actually sit just above your ear on a special part of the bone called the mastoid process. And they vibrate onto that bone, and as a process of that vibration, you can actually hear it in your ears, and nobody else can.
You know, sometimes I see people with hearing aids like that.
Yes, this is kind of it is not quite the same design. Those are a little more carefully designed. These are really kind of designed to be sporty kind of headphones. Mm-hmm. I found myself needing them when I was riding my bike a lot because cars don't really care if you are smaller than them. If you are in their way, they would prefer that you not be. So I wanted to be able to hear the world around me while I was also kind of riding and listening to things. And these were really just kind of the best headphones for that. I can, you know, very comfortably wear these for an entire day and listen to my favorite podcast or music or anything while doing things. And because they are bone conduction headphones, I can hear the music that I'm playing very clearly, but I can also hear the sounds of the outside world very clearly.
All right. So doesn't it get to be too much?
There are environments if there's just an overwhelming amount of sound. Like, I actually live near an airport, and when there is an airplane taking off, then yes, that is a situation where it can be just a little too much sound. But in most cases, it's pretty easy to focus on one or the other. But anytime that the outside world is just so loud that you normally be able to hear it through normal headphones anyway, then yes, that can be a problem.
And how do they feel?
It feels like I have a little headband just kind of squeezing the side of my head a little bit. It is comfortable enough that I have worn them for entire days and forgotten that they are actually on my head.
Wow.
Which actually caused a doctor's office to once think that I had hearing aids on and try to speak very long and quiet to me. But yeah, it's just these are very comfortable headphones. These are headphones that I recommend to anyone. But it's difficult because these are headphones that I typically only recommend to people that I can show them, because it is difficult to describe the bone conduction experience until you have felt it for yourself.
And how much do they cost?
These are $100 on Amazon. Okay. And you can also find them in Best Buy stores if you have one near you.
Great ideas, Russell. Thank you so much.
No problem. These are really easy things that can... The idea here is the stuff you can get this week if you absolutely needed to get somebody something.
Last-minute gifts. All great ideas. The Anker external battery, the Fire TV stick, Arcade 1-Up, and headphones. Russell Holly, I hope you have a great holiday.
Thanks. I hope you do, too. And everyone else who's listening.
Everybody else who's listening. Thanks for listening today to Tech Tuesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.